take your seats, please.
This is a meeting of the Utah State Tax Commission. It's being held at approximately 8:30 in the morning on Thursday, December 7th, 2017. It's being held at the Davis Conference Center, which is located at 1651 North, 700 West, Layton, Utah, 840441. I'm John Valentine. I'm calling the meeting to order. I'm the chairman of the Utah Tax Commission. I'm joined today by Commissioner Michael Cragen and Commissioner Robert Pirro. Commissioner Rebecca Rockwell is asked to be excused this morning. Also has asked to be excused is our executive director, Barry Conover. It's hard to believe that there are actually people that still have to work down the tax commission. They can't be here all week, so we had to do a little bit of splitting up this morning. I'd like to make a couple of initial comments about the training that we've just had and the session schools we've just had. I was particularly impressed with this session, and I'm going to allow my commissioners to also make some opening comments as well. This particular session school was very, very good. In fact, for me, a couple of high points was the opening presentation by our chief of staff, Justin Harding, and by Mr. Polson. I was just really, really impressed with that. In the afternoon of the first day, Ada Anderson's presentation was one that I presented, that I attended, and she did such a really good job. I don't want to call out each of the individual ones because there were so many really good ones, but those are ones that just were high points for me personally because I was really impressed with the quality of the presentations, the quality of the preparation, and the interaction that we had. The number of participants seems to grow each year, and so that is a mark that it's actually worthwhile. This part of the conference, which is the closing part of the conference, is intended to give an open mic to the assessors and to other county government officials to be able to talk to us about things that are affecting you or the things that you'd like us to hear about. Oftentimes in the past, before we started doing this as a commission, you didn't have that opportunity. So this is to give you that opportunity to be able to address formally the commission and to create a record of some of the things that you're concerned about. With those opening comments, I'd like to turn to first Commissioner Pirro, Commissioner Cragen first, and then Commissioner Pirro in that order, and then we'll open the mic up for issues for the various county assessors and property tax division representatives. Commissioner Cragen.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. It's great to be with you again. This is my ninth assessor school in a row now. I just had my anniversary of when I very first was appointed to the commission. I thought that the presentations that I attended to were particularly fine this year, and I appreciate all the effort that goes into that. I do have some issues that we have identified that we wanted to talk with you about, and I've had a few of you mention to me things that you'd like us to talk about. Is now the time to do that, or do you want to do
you
that
bet.
Later?
It's very open.
Okay. All right, so Commissioner Rockwell actually mentioned this in Ada's presentation on preparing for a hearing, but we just wanted to mention it again here, and that is please notify us as soon as possible if you have an appeal stipulate, particularly if it's one that someone is traveling from Salt Lake to your county to conduct the appeal hearing. We had one that had stipulated, I believe, in Washington County, and Robert and Rebecca didn't know about it before they left. Now, I think the county had attempted to send it to us, but it hadn't gotten through. So if, in addition to sending us the stipulation documents, you would call our clerk and just say there's a stipulation on the way, the parties have signed it or whatever, then they can plan ahead. Every once in a while, we have the parties call us and say, yep, we're gonna stipulate, but until we actually see a signed form, we won't take it off the calendar because there's always a chance that it could fall apart. So if you could help us with that, we would appreciate that. Then we got an email from Cache County, I believe it was from the auditor's office. Yes, from the auditor's office. And asking about appeal rights. And they wanted to know if they could drop the appeal rights off of some particular issues. In fact, the one that they're dealing with is a, I think it was an indigent appeal. Just gives the name of the tax. Oh, hardship appeal. It was a hardship appeal. Okay, well, and they're saying, we don't think the tax commission has the authority to hear this. Do we need to put appeal rights on? Interestingly enough, we also had one very recently from Salt Lake County, and their Salt Lake County attorney actually did argue at the hearing that the tax commission did not have jurisdiction to hear the appeal. And because they raised that argument and because the law supported their argument, we actually granted their motion to dismiss. In the process of doing that, though, we identified that there is enough ambiguity in the law that we think that the safe bet for now is to continue to tell taxpayers that they have the right to appeal. Because there are some instances where something that looks like a hardship appeal or looks like an indigent abatement might actually go through the Board of Equalization and then might have rights to go to the Tax Commission. Whereas there are other situations where something might only be in the discretion of the County Commission, the County Legislative Body, and there are no appeal rights to the Tax Commission. Because there's enough ambiguity, we're suggesting that you go ahead and keep putting the rights on your notices, and then if somebody appeals, we can deal with it then. This is an issue that we are going to bring to the legislature's attention to say, are you aware that there's this kind of disparity, and is that the policy you want? And if they want it, then we'll address it at that point and talk about whether or not appeal rights are still appropriate. Comments? Go ahead, Denny.
Let me just say something about the microphones. We're dual mic'd on the commission microphones so that the speakers and the recording both work. Unfortunately, we can't get the speakers to work on the second mic, so we're going to ask you to always speak into the microphone so that it's on the recording, and that's why we're going to pass the microphone around. Denny, please start off.
And identify yourself when you speak.
Who are you?
Denny Lytle. Oh. Property Tax Division Director. My question is,
his mic is not going
this,
through the
This
PA.
Is only for the recording, not, it won't go through the speakers.
And it is going through the recording.
So what were we just talking about?
Appeal rights.
Appeal rights. I'm having a bad week. I think my memory is getting shorter. Yes, I did.
Okay, we were talking about giving people notice and that there's some ambiguity in the law.
Oh, thank you for saving me.
Yeah.
My question is, you would, so there is some bright line distinctions though in this. You wouldn't hear, this is a question, would you hear an appeal based on a 59-2-1347 abatement?
We don't think that we have the authority, well, we know that we don't have the authority to do those. And I can't remember if the one that came out of Cache County was under that section of the code. I don't think it was. But the auditor, the deputy auditor in her email actually spells out all of the laws that say, well, if it's this way, yes, and if it's that way, yes, and it's not clear this way, and so she thinks that she ought to keep giving notice, and we agree.
The difficulty is that it appears that there are some groups specifically we do not have jurisdiction on, some we clearly have jurisdiction on, and there's a gray area in the middle that we're not certain on, and the case that we just ruled on recently indicated that unclarity. We ruled that we did not have jurisdiction under that particular appeal, based upon the way it was presented to us and the procedure that happened below. But we're asking the legislature to clarify that, if that's what they want us to do, the way we ruled, or do they want to have the appeal rights go to the commission in a broader sense? Or do they want to change entirely their policy as part of our appeal rights from the counties, especially on the issues of abatement?
Kathleen, do you remember on the appeal that came from Cache County what the outcome of it was? Did we uphold the county, or did we say that we didn't have authority to hear the case?
You actually upheld the county, but we didn't make the I wasn't there, but I don't believe we argued you didn't have authority. Right. I think your decision was based on the facts that were given in the case.
Right. Okay.
That's my understanding.
I think that was my recollection, too.
I think you're right.
That Salt Lake County's attorney actually made the argument the commission does not have jurisdiction, and Cache County did not make that argument. But they still won. Okay. All right, the next issue is, and Denny brought this to my attention, that there was some discussion about the 10-day exchange. And I brought here a copy of a notice for an initial hearing. You probably see these frequently. Down here at the bottom, it says, you must deliver copies of any evidence to the opposing party and to the tax appeals unit no later than 10 business days prior to the hearing. And then it gives the instructions for how to submit it to the unit. And then at the very end it says, failure to provide copies of the evidence to the opposing party and tax appeals in advance may result in the evidence being excluded from consideration. Okay, this is not formally designated as a scheduling order, which the commission has the authority to issue. It's a notice, but it has the effect of an order of the commission. And so this is the only place in law that the 10-day exchange exists. It's something that we have established as a standing order of the tax commission. So it's not in the Constitution or in the statute or in the rules. It's just here in this notice, because we are an administrative appeals body. We consider that to be a standing order. And there was some question as to the origin of that requirement.
And it is consistent with the district court's practice. They do the same thing. They oftentimes will do it in a scheduling order. And so we have done it in a standing order, as Commissioner Cragen has indicated, so that our practice is very similar to the district court practice, that we have a deadline prior to the time of the hearing. That deadline is 10 days.
In the case of some of the big appeals, like Paul and his group do for the centrally assessed taxpayers, they're actually complex enough that the attorneys and the judge will sit down together and they'll plan out, usually almost a year in advance, these are the dates that things have to happen. Appraisals are exchanged here, expert reports are exchanged here, evidence is submitted here, and so forth. And in that case, there is a scheduling order, and it supersedes the standing order. And but the cases that I don't think any of your cases would have scheduling orders. Well,
no, they have.
They could, but generally speaking, they don't.
I know we had some from the Woods Cross refinery.
That's true. That's right. Okay. So, other questions on the 10-day note, 10-day exchange? Go ahead.
Denny Lytle, Property Tax Division. So I'll ask for Cindy. I know that she has been approached by Steve Preston and other tax reps that are now arguing that 10-day rule applies to the local boards as well. Do you have any thoughts or input about that?
I have not taken an official position on that, but we can give you our individual opinions. Our individual opinions is that it does not, that the local boards can make their own rules in regards to discovery and process. But that's the chairman's opinion. I'll let anybody else express opinions if they want.
Well, and I agree with the chairman's opinion, and it's because it's done by a standing order of the tax commission. We could adopt an administrative rule imposing that upon the parties at the boards of equalization. And the county legislative bodies, if I remember correctly, also have the authority to adopt their own ordinance establishing rules for their boards of equalization. So they could do it too, but just this order itself does not apply to the county boards.
In my previous life, when I was the clerk auditor in Carbon County had adopted an ordinance and requiring the 10-day.
Other discussion on the 10-day exchange of evidence? All right, the last thing that I have on my list is an interesting case out of Cache County. And Kathleen asked me to bring it up. I think she may have some discussion after I kind of lay out the facts and the decision. So,
you're up.
This was an interesting case. Kathleen, do you remember, did you guys go to mediation or did everybody just waive the initial and come right to a formal?
We actually went to mediation, but it was evident within about 5 minutes this was not a topic that could be mediated because it was really a question of law, right? And so, right, exactly.
Yeah. It's appeal number 151781. I believe that this one has been redacted. It's the year.
And before we go on, I got to tell you a little story about yurts. And then,
yes. Okay. It's a good story.
For those of you who don't know, many times I've taken State Department assignments to go visit places that you can hardly pronounce. Part of it coming back from my military career, following came back from the time that I served as the President of the Senate and other leadership roles in the legislative side. So one of my assignments was to go to the Kyrgyz Republic, which is, we pronounce in English, the Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is not the best place to go for a tourist visit. In fact, it's got a lot of terrorists and other things going on there, so it's not the best thing to do. My assignment was to go to negotiate a lease for the Manassas Air Force Base in Bishkek, which is the capital city of Kyrgyzstan. And the Manassas Air Force Base is a place where they have the forward efforts from the first Afghan war. And so we were trying to negotiate this Air Force Base lease. During the process, sometimes the translators would laugh at a little joke that was going on. I could only understand enough Russian to understand that I was the butt of the joke. And so I was asking them, well, what was the joke about? And they said, well, you say you're from Utah. And I said, that's how they pronounce Utah. And I said, yes, I'm from Utah. And they all started laughing again. And they said, so you live in a Utah in Utah? And I said, oh yes, I live in a house in Utah. And so that was the running joke in Kyrgyzstan. Well, they decided that they didn't want to make fun of the person that was heading up the delegation. And so they gave me a Bushkashi horse. Huh. Now, does anybody know what a Bushkashi horse is? Come on, we're rural guys. Don't we know what a Bushkashi horse is? I didn't know what it was either. Well, Bushkashi is the national sport of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. And this horse is a big horse. It's almost like the size of a draft horse, but it is fast and is strong. And the Bushkashi is done by having a dead goat filled with wet sand until it weighs 90 stone. And it's placed in a center of the field, and then both sides of the field, about the size of a football field, five horsemen line up on each side of it. Now the goal is to try to get the dead goat out of the center, and everybody's trying to fight you, and they have these little whips they hit each other with and hit everybody's horses with, to get to the other side, to your side, back to your side, to kind of like capture the flag with the dead goat, and throw it in this great big old barbecue pit. And whoever gets it in the barbecue pit gets to roast the goat. So that's what they gave me, was this horse that was one of these great horses they used to play this sport of Bushkashi. But that is my story about living in a yurta in Utah. Paraluski and Dobri Den.
I actually
recalled that story as I was reading through this case. So we've got almost a 42-acre parcel of property, and on that parcel of property is a former porta potty that has been adapted to serve as an outhouse. And there is also a platform with a yurt, on it. And the county has assessed an acre of land as being a secondary home site and has assessed value of the yurt and the other improvements that are there on that acre site. And then the rest of the land is in greenbelt. The taxpayer comes in and makes the argument that the yurt should not be taxed as real property, that it is personal property, and that that part of the valuation should be eliminated. And so he argued that the owner of the real estate doesn't own the yurt. Another person who had used it at one time for business purposes as an office, a real estate office in the area, actually owns it. Probably the most important fact is that the way that the yurt is constructed is that there are concrete pads, not where they've poured concrete, but just a concrete block, I guess is the right way to say it. Concrete blocks that are laid out in a pattern, and then the deck is built on top of it, and then the yurt goes around it. And so they argued that because this yurt was not permanently attached to the land, and because removing it would not do any damage to the yurt or to the structure that attaches it to the land, that it does not qualify as either real estate or an improvement to real estate. So as you know, that once something is attached once personal property is attached to real estate, it becomes either real estate or an improvement to the real estate, and it's taxed as real estate. And so they made this argument. And our decision was based very much on that statutory standard, that if it's not an improvement, if it can be removed without doing any damage to the structure that attaches it to the land or to the piece of personal property itself. So the taxpayer won on that account. I've since learned that the taxpayer was disappointed that he lost on the more valuable part. And that is that we said that the county correctly assessed that acre of land as a home site because it had been improved. Improvements had been made, a driveway had been put in, grading had been done so that yurt would be level when it was there. The outhouse was established there. All of those constitute home site improvements, and so they could tax it as a home site. I believe that the taxpayer's desire was to be able to say this is all green belt and there's no home site and there is no improvement on it, and so we get to tax the whole thing as green belt, but we still get to have our recreational structure there and to be able to enjoy it. Oh shoot, I'm having a Denny moment.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say, is that there was actually testimony that the yurt had been moved prior to its placement on in its current location. I think we learned that the movement had happened 6 years prior. But it had in fact been moved, and it was the desire of the parties to sell the yurt to someone else, and then it would be moved away at that point. OK. Okay, so those are the facts of the case. The decision of the case was, taxpayer, you're right, your $12,000 yurt isn't taxed, but the county is correct, their $100,000 home site value is upheld. So that's how the case turned out. We did decide that in this particular case, a yurt is personal property. One of the interesting things that we learned is that there is a ski resort in Cache County that also has a couple of yurts that are claimed on their personal property return, and so they're taxed as personal property rather than real property. But there are plenty of other yurts in Cache County that excuse me, that are treated as improvements and taxed as real property. That brought to mind that there was one other fact, and that is that in Cache County, if you're going to set up a yurt, you have to have a building permit. And this taxpayer did not have a building permit, but the ruling of the tax commission was they should have gotten a building permit, and therefore we were going to that added to our decision that the first acre was a home site. So I think those are all the facts, all of my commentary. Kathleen, what's the questions we need to talk about? Or what other things do you want to add?
So a couple questions. The decision was that the yurt is personal property, but that doesn't mean it's exempt. I'm assuming as personal property, we would still charge them as personal property. It wouldn't be considered under the household furnishings exemption. I believe you would treat it something similar. We've never done this, so this is a new. I suspect you would treat it something like a mobile home or a manufactured home in a park, some kind of a something. So we would. That would be my assumption. So we would send them a bill as personal property. If it was, as the taxpayer argued, it was he said that the wife of the owner of the property owned the yurt. She is a real estate agent in Weber County. She is not a real estate agent in Cache County. He said in his testimony that the yurt was used as a sales office. The day we were at the yurt, I didn't want to call him a liar, but the day we were at the yurt, it is actually being used as housing for construction workers.
And I think that was in the order.
Yeah, so while it might be for sale, I guess everything we all own is for sale at the right price. So that became part of the challenge. I don't believe it. The property is not zoned for a commercial business. They do not have a business license in Utah or in Cache County. So I don't believe it would fall under the personal property, a business personal property signed statement, because there is no business there. I would believe we would just send a separate bill for personal property, but I don't know the answer to that. So that's my first question.
Okay. We can't answer that question. So my advice to you would be is if you think that's the right way to do it, to send a bill for personal property, do so, but then understand that the taxpayer, the property owner, will have the right then to appeal to us and ask those questions.
Okay.
And then we'll have to have a presentation by both sides so that we can make a legal determination whether or not it's subject to the household exemption, whether or not it's business personal property that should be reported or at least taxed, and so forth. So those questions were not answered in this order. There were enough facts in here to suggest that it could be treated as a mobile home or it could be treated as business property, but that decision was not made in this order. And in this setting, we can't answer your question the way you framed it.
That's correct.
Okay. My second question is, and as soon as I saw the order, my brain just started racing, because I always believed that if there was improvements made to the land, we had real property or an improvement that we were taxing as real property, and improvements were made to the land for the home site or whatever the improvement is, that if it was treated as real property, we could add a site value. And this gentleman, that was his argument. He believed, as I did, that if it was personal property, I couldn't add the site improvement. So this case told us something different, because they do make improvements to the land.
Yeah, the road and the
level. Yeah, he had actually leveled it. There's gravel all the way down. Yes, absolutely. So then my question came on other properties that are in Greenbelt, where improvements are made to the land for personal property. Can we add site values? In the past, I believe it's been the practice that we always added a site value. If a cabin was built on it or a house was built on it, we'd add a home site value. Can we add a site value for other personal property? My thought, of course, is Powder Mountain. It is in Greenbelt. A lot of improvement is done to that mountain, without any question, that has nothing to do with skiing. Or, excuse me, has nothing to do with farming, right, with agricultural use. It does have to do with a different purpose. I've never added a site value unless it was a building. Can I then, with personal property, where the lifts are, where other things are done, can I add a commercial site value for the improvement to that property?
I think we have to say the same answer, that until that's before us in an appeal, we can't really rule on it. I will just tell you personally that those potential facts sound a lot more fraught than the ones with this yurt. So if I were going to do something like that, I would want to put together a really strong argument for why the law allows me to do that, and then be prepared to come in and make that argument. And you know, I think that's something certainly the property tax division and the county assessors can work together on, trying to figure out how that might be done. But again, understand that the property owner is going to have the right to appeal to us, and then we'll have to look at the facts and the law and decide.
Okay.
As you well know, we cannot pre-rule on a case and try to determine a case before it actually is presented to us. That's why we're showing the reticence to make that kind of determination. Question, Craig?
Those are all the things that I had on my list. Okay. So
let's turn then to Commissioner Perro.
Thank you. I would just like to echo my fellow commissioner's comments on the assessor school this year. I thought it was fantastic. I think the property tax division raised the bar this year in the quality of the breakout sessions. Me personally, there's a couple of them that I really like. I like it when the assessors take either the assessor or employees from their office and do a presentation. And there's two of them that I attended that I thought were really well. The Ada Anderson one, which we just are really high on. We think she does an excellent job. I think all of us have been in appeals where she presented for Salt Lake County, and she just did an excellent job. And the other one that I liked was the one for personal property that Monica Dolan did. When they come out and they show you what they do in their office, that really helps them out, and they present it to the whole group, I think we all learn from that.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Time is now yours. And this is the time that you can ask questions, and obviously some we can't answer, and some we'll have to defer, just like we did with Kathleen. So, Danny, if you'll kind of take the mic around, and somebody kind of looks like they have the urge, that'd be helpful.
Anybody have the urge?
And this is not an ecclesiastical meeting that certain faiths have, where you come up and, you know, this is the time to ask questions. I'll leave it at that. Commissioner Uhlberry, come on. You're usually the one that has one that just burden on.
Did I get promoted?
You did. Sorry, Assessor
Uhlberry. We've had our eye on you for years.
Well, thank you very much. Our colleague Cindy Bullock brought an issue up yesterday, and she, well, fortunately for her, she's doing something. She's in Las Vegas at the rodeo, having a good time. But she brought it up a couple years ago. There was a case out of Salt Lake where there was, I believe, a professor at the University of Utah has a primary residence in Salt Lake, and then his spouse had a primary residence in South Carolina. And the tax commission ruled on the plain language of the law that says you can only have one primary residence within the state, and the property owner receives a residential exemption. And so I guess our question here is, well, when we brought it up the next year to the legislature, we thought, well, that's going to be an easy fix. We'll just strike out the phrase "in the state," and everything will be good and right with the world. And as most things that are legislative, it turned out to be considerably more complicated than that. So we dropped it. So I guess our question is, do you believe that there's a legislative fix that will be appropriate for that and for that particular issue? And second, how would you be able to offer a recommendation on how we should go at it?
I think the way that you approached it, to just strike the words "in this state," would solve your problem. But because of the way the legislature has structured the domicile statutes for income tax, it could create a problem. Just so you know, if you don't already, that if a taxpayer has children in the public schools, doesn't matter where their primary residence is, if their kids are going to our schools, they're domiciled in Utah, they pay Utah income tax on all of their income, not just the Utah source income. If they take the primary residential exemption, then they are presumed to be domiciled in Utah, but they can give us a good reason why they shouldn't be. If they register to vote in Utah, they're presumed to be domiciled in Utah, but they can give us a good reason why they shouldn't be. There's one other thing. If the taxpayer or the taxpayer's spouse is enrolled in the public higher education institutions, then they're also presumed, but they can give us a good reason why they shouldn't be. And then after that, we just look at a bunch of factors. They also have the affirmative duty that if they're receiving the primary residential exemption and they desire to change their income tax domicile, that they have to notify the county that they no longer want the primary residential exemption, or that they no longer qualify for the primary residential exemption, and they're supposed to notify the county or at least put it on their tax return so that the government is notified. So because of that income tax connection, that's what causes all of the problem. As I said, the easy fix to your question is strike those three words. But it then starts to create other problems for the administration of the income tax.
The broader issue is, does the legislature even want to make the change? Or are they satisfied with the provision where you have one in the state, leaving open the possibility you could have one in some other state as well? You've heard the intersection between the domicile statute and the property exemption statute. We outlined that to the legislature, and they've chosen not to move forward with it. If they so choose in the future to move forward with it, then we will deal with it at that time. But we're stuck with a plain language reading of the statute. We don't know how to do anything other than that.
Well, let me just add one thing. I don't know if you all know it or not, but when the legislature is on, Commissioner Valentine and Commissioner Rockwell handle everything at the legislature. Commissioner Cragen and myself handle everything at the tax commission. So these legislative questions, Commissioner Valentine and Rockwell usually have all the information.
And we really, really appreciate being able to do that, because it allows us to have access to the legislature, give input to the legislature, and try to affect the outcomes in the legislature. For example, the major efforts that are going on in the legislature this summer, and it'll slow slop over into the general session dealing with tax reform, we've had a chance to have our voice heard on that because these two commissioners are able to kind of hold down the fort down at the tax commission on things that we would normally all be required to do. So the commission actually has had a good success right now with that model of being able to have access to the legislature, but still getting our work done at the commission itself, thanks to Commissioner Craig and Commissioner Perro.
But if you are tired of seeing the two of us in your formal hearings, we can probably fix it so you get one of the other two sometimes.
Just have to do it other than January, February, March.
So, Mr. Uliberry, have we given you any insight? Are there more questions?
No, I think you've covered it appropriately. Assessors are generally simple, and we want to do the right thing for the right reason. It strikes us as a general rule as a bit odd. We feel as though as it we're not challenging your ruling because I personally believe that you ruled appropriately, but it violates the spirit of the law. We're not policymakers, and neither are you. That's really a legislative decision. And if they've chosen to leave it as it is, I guess we have to interpret it as their intent is to only have one primary residence within the state. I think our one of our biggest difficulties come from counties where, you know, they're just choosing the most expensive home and then claiming that as their primary residence when they don't actually live there. But I think our hands are tied somewhat. If they provide, you know, a voter registration and an income tax, even if they're not occupying the home for the 183 days, we're stuck. And so it's frustrating to some of us.
On that second issue, which is really a real strong first cousin of the first issue, we've suggested to the legislature they may want to consider codifying the practice that some counties do, similar to Washington County, which is require an annual statement or an annual information showing why you still qualify for it, or asking if you do still qualify for it, and that statement be done in a penalty of perjury, so that we have a factual basis upon which we grant the residential exemption each year. That one has not been rejected, and so that one you may see some additional things coming forward on that one. I do know that there's been some discussion about changing tax rates. You heard during the conference about the freezing, the basic levy, and those sorts of things. It may end up in that kind of a bill. It wouldn't be a standalone bill, but would end up as a provision in that sort of bill. So, to the extent you have access to Senator Stevenson, who is the primary sponsor of that bill, you may want to make known this issue again about the problems dealing with verification of qualification for a primary residential exemption. Other questions? Have one here.
Okay. Joe Thompson, Garfield County Assessor. My question is, if a taxpayer agrees with the Board of Equalization, can they later on then appeal that value to the tax commission on a particular property?
So you're saying that the assessor and the taxpayer come to an agreement at the County Board of Equalization?
Mm-hmm.
And then within the appeal period, the taxpayer changes their mind and appeals to the tax commission. I think that's the question. I've been framing the question.
That's right. That's correct. Asking.
I've not heard of that one either.
So ask the question, would it be different if the stipulation was in writing?
So would it be different if the stipulation was in writing?
Why don't you present those to us and let us decide? Yeah. I don't think we can really decide here.
Okay.
I'll just tell you that my reaction is that as long as they're within the window of after, because the County Board of Equalization, once there's a stipulation, that stipulation has the effect of the notice of decision of the Board of Equalization. If the taxpayer then decides that they want to appeal that notice of decision to the tax commission within the statutory time period, I think that we would probably, at the very least, hold a hearing and decide whether or not we have jurisdiction. And my initial reaction is that we probably do. So, but that's a really odd situation.
What? Well, I know, but there's some odd taxpayers in Garfield County, as you know. So,
how did you know that's who I was talking about?
You only have one taxpayer who appeals.
Oh, ouch.
We were shocked when he agreed with one of his problems.
Yeah, we were too. We actually had a party.
Denny Lytle, what if the stipulation, the written stipulation, contained wording that this was a final and unappealable order, or final and some language that said this is the end?
You're making contract law arguments, and I don't know what our authority is dealing with contract law. I mean, it's certainly an issue to bring up. And if we did enter into a decision, then the next thing I would do if I represented the county is go to the Supreme Court and say there was a contract law provision here that should have prevented the tax commission, and then find out from the Supreme Court what they think. But we don't usually enforce contracts.
Usually we interpret them, so don't enforce them.
So we didn't get anything in writing because our hearing officer just wrote no change. So all we have is just the recording of it.
And has the time period expired for appeal?
Yes, it has now.
Okay, good. So.
But that is an interesting one that we may have to face someday. But we don't have a good ruling on that one without having the actual facts in front of us. Yes.
Steve Martin, Summit County. It's always been Summit County's, and yes, we are like Washington County, where we have within a few hundred homes, 50-50 primary and non-primary. We kind of avoid going to the tax commission if they appeal their residency status, because in previous commissions, they've been very liberal in their interpretation of whether it's the intent or whether it's the actual usage of the property. We, in Summit County, say that there has to be a warm body in there for 183 days consecutively before the warm body qualifies the structure, where in other counties, the type of structure actually qualifies the property. So the intent is that any residential structure is considered, the intent is for it to be a primary residence. Now, I know we have an ordinance that says, since we can't tell, you have to ask for it. We start with 100% as per the Constitution, and then any exemption is applied after that. But it's something they have to apply for. If there was and I think I've only won one appeal on primary residence where they indicated it was actually the usage that qualified and not the intent. Do you have any philosophical leanings one way or the other on whether it's usage or intent?
Can you give us any more facts on the one that you won?
It was what I considered slave quarters in a large hotel in Deer Valley. They had kind of like dorm rooms with just a bathroom and a bedroom with four South American employees of the hotel, the Montage. And there was no kitchen or anything like that. They had to eat in the cafeteria, and they couldn't show themselves above the ground level because they were working down below or out on the ski slopes. They were there from December to maybe March for the ski season. And if they messed up, they would be fired, and then they would lose their housing, and then they'd have to go back to whatever country it was. So they argued that the intent of those 10 rooms was to be the primary residence of those migrant workers. And we argued, no, it was actual use. They had to be used as someone's primary residence before they qualified. So it was a usage that they didn't, that wasn't qualifying because they were only there for 3 months. And they argued it was the intent of the property owners to make it their primary residence.
Okay. So it sounds like your facts really supported your argument that, right, that this really is temporary housing, not primary housing.
Right. But if we were to bring another, I know it's based on case by case, but if we were to bring another primary where they argued it was the intent versus the actual usage, the most prominent one I have is where a person is living in one home and building another home next to it. And under the old commissions, they said, well, the intent of the second home is going to be a primary. And so they get two primary residencies, even though I understood the law to be that they can only have one.
That was before the statute was changed, too. So we may end up having a different ruling based on the current statute.
Okay.
Another thing that has tweaked my interest a little bit is, and this is when I'll get back to the whole group for a minute, a statutory change to provide that the residential exemption must have a 183-day requirement. Do we codify that? That may end up actually solving the issue that we have of having two primary residences, one in one state and one in our state. If we codify the number of days you have to occupy it, I'm thinking out loud now, but your point is sort of led me into a direction that maybe we got to approach the legislature instead of saying in the state, just striking in the state, which has all of the problems that we're talking about with domicile. We define the primary residence as saying it must be occupied 183 days out of a year to qualify for the primary residence. Consecutive days or something like that. I'm just thinking out loud now, okay? I'm not trying to get an advanced rule on anything, but I'm just saying, give me an idea to go back to the legislature on. It's another way to approach the issue that John Mulberry wrote. Give me your reaction as county assessors and county employees. Yes. Bring the microphone up here, Denny.
Tom Durant from Washington County. I was just going to bring up that's in the household definition.
What?
The within the state is in the household definition.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. But still, we still have the ability to solve, I think, a problem that's been we've been talking about today by having something like that.
I think his point would be is that it would have to go into the exemption statute rather than into the household definition section to be able to work that way.
Well, it would be in the exemption statute, but it would be a 180-day requirement, 183-day continuous occupancy requirement or something like that to be a bright-line test so that you no longer have. And then as you, if you do codify the application process, one of the things on the application box is have you continuously occupied this for prior 183 days the prior year or something like that.
So I guess that we'd want to have some discussion about if some counties would like that and others would not, because it just, is Salt Lake County going to want to have to administer all of their residential properties as if they are secondary until somebody comes in and applies for it, and then the 183-day requirement. I mean, if you've got properties where you've got tenants moving in and out, if it's empty for a month, what does that do? There are just lots of issues that I think we need to think through, but maybe we could deal with it by saying that it's only 4th through 6th counties, class counties, that had to have that
required. There's no rational basis to do that.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, I think it's a good idea. In fact, when you talked about the number of days that the property was occupied, I kept thinking, is that in the property tax statute? I don't think that is. So.
Let's play with this, okay? Because this is something I think that would be worthwhile to approach the legislature about once we got a unified front on it, so we knew how to approach it. Because Commissioner Cragen has correctly identified what may be good for a 4th, 5th, or 6th class county may be horrible for a 1st class county. So again, that's how legislation is done. You start up with an idea, you start playing with it, you start working with it, you refine it, and you come up with something that is workable for everybody. So there's a challenge for you. Thank you very much. Good point. Other questions? I think we had one here from Salt Lake County.
Kevin Jacobs, Salt Lake County. Back to that topic for just 1 second.
Yeah, please.
We have 263,000 primary residential or residential units. We would not be in favor of sending those the questionnaires out or processing those on a yearly basis. It'd be a slight problem.
We'll come up with a rational basis why we only apply it to 4th, 5th, or 6th class counties. I think we got it.
Yeah. Be good. Be nice. And the last Rev and Tax meeting, Senator Stevenson's tax revision bill was discussed for quite some time.
The majority of the meeting.
Yes.
About 5 or 6 hour meeting.
At the end of the meeting, there was a discussion on personal property of $1,000 exemption per item. Just to be clear on that, that was just Senator McKay's thinking or looking for something. That wasn't part of the bill, was it?
We're worried that it may become part of the bill, and we think it's a real harsh burden on both the taxpayer and upon the taxing agencies. We don't think that Representative McKay has really gotten through all the thinking process necessary to really formulate what it's going to do. We actually suggested to Representative McKay, I think in the meeting on the record, if I remember correctly, that he not do that, that he not keep that component part. We were concerned specifically about how to determine the component parts. Let's go into a restaurant. Is a table separate from a chair? Is each chair separate from a unit? Let's go to a business. You buy a computer. Is the screen a separate component from the keyboard, which is a separate component from the CPU, which is a separate component from the server that the CPUs are all attached to? It becomes very, very, very difficult if we try to have it on each individual item. We suggested to Representative McKay that we increase the exemption amount and that we have the legislature make some legislative findings and actually do some fact-finding of the burden that that has and how it is de minimis if we had a higher exemption. So instead of having the $10,000 exemption, we have the a $30,000 exemption. I think Commissioner Rockwell gave kind of a hypothetical of a $30,000 exemption. If the legislature would do some legislative fact-finding and then put those on the record, which would then satisfy the requirement of Article 13, Section 3, so that we could have some way to defend it, and to apply it equally and uniformly so that centrally assessed taxpayers would also get a blanket $30,000 or $20,000 personal property exemption in the calculation, so that those that came in from unitary valuation, for example, would come in with their worldwide unitary value, have their allocation factor to Utah, pull out their tangibles, then have their allocation factor to Utah, then from that allocation factor in Utah, there would be a $30,000 deduction for personal property so that it was equally uniform applied across to all taxpayers, no matter how they were assessed. At that point, that would be the value that would be taxed for purposes of that centrally assessed taxpayer. We suggested that as a model that would be a better model, both for the taxpayer and for the individuals. If you remember, there was a Candace Daly who spoke against the idea of having to keep track of each individual component. So some of the business community told us privately afterwards they really don't like that idea of having to keep track of those individual components, which they would have to do if they were trying to exempt those out. We like the idea of just a higher exemption, and then a fact finding that goes on the record to sustain that, so that it can sustain constitutional challenge.
Well, I thought you were very clear that was your preference, but I just wasn't clear whether McKay's idea was in the bill or not in the bill, and where that stood.
In the draft bill that we were considering in that meeting, because he was just raising the issue. But we were worried it could end up in the bill. Jennifer, you saw that final draft. Was it in that final draft of the bill?
What we were discussing at the last meeting.
Jennifer Hansen will be on the record next.
Oh. Jennifer Hansen, property tax. The bill they were discussing, the draft on Monday, did have that language in the bill. Not the $30,000, but the $1,000 acquisition cost and getting rid of the 15%. Depreciation.
Because what they've done is they deleted some language that was in the present version of the statute, which left a $1,000 exemption.
Right, but it got rid of the 15% depreciation and just anything that was a $1,000 acquisition cost, so it is there at the moment. But that bill did not go with us out as a committee bill, so I still think it's just for discussion purposes.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, Jennifer. So, Adam, that's your answer. It was in that discussion draft. What we've done on behalf of the commission. Probably wouldn't hurt to have the counties echo that, and then have some of the county's taxpayers, especially some of the businesses that would have to now keep track for purposes of their exempt amount, the actual purchases, and then we have all the arguments about whether or not it was a component part of a bigger system or whether it was the system itself. That, I think, is going to be fraught with litigation. Good question. Other questions? Other comments? I know everybody's just really not there today. Awake today. Okay,
Kathleen Howell, Cache County Assessor. I just want to go back to the 10-day exchange of information. We had some discussion in the assessors group about this at UAC, and there were many, myself included, that expressed some frustration in that exchange. And so that's why we got into the discussion of where is it in the law, why do we have to do it, so on and so forth. I certainly can see the benefit. There's a reason you do that. I understand that. But just using this case of the yurt, the taxpayer nor his attorney provided any information. There was no exchange. So we provided a three-ring binder with 8x10 color glossies, the whole nine yards. We send that to them. We get nothing back. We get to the hearing. They go first. And you will recall that I became a little frustrated that they were merely going through all of our evidence, using what we were providing, and just discrediting it before I had even presented it. I was a bit frustrated with that. I'm just wondering how we go about that. I recognize that if they present evidence that day, we can say it wasn't. Our goal really is to get to value. So I can tell you it's doubtful. Most of us would say we don't want them to be able to present anything. I think our goal's value. But it is a bit discouraging when we provide all of this on the county side, the time and the effort, nothing's done on their side. I don't know how you respond to that.
Mr. Craig, you want to set through that hearing.
And we actually get this, we see this a lot, where a party that's presenting their case in chief really spends all of their time attacking the opponent's evidence as opposed to presenting what their position is. And I loss for a suggestion. I mean, the obvious thing, the kind of the implication of your question is, if they don't send us anything, why should we send them anything? But then you would be prevented from presenting it at the hearing. They do have the burden of proof, but I think that without having all of your pictures and stuff, that the decision might not have gone the way it did, that your information really was helpful to us. So you got any suggestions from a litigator's standpoint about how to deal with having your evidence being co-opted by the opponent?
No, I've done it before.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Sometimes my opponent had better illustrations on what we're trying to do, and then we would use some of their things that we found in discovery or that they'd submitted to us. I think that's just the way litigation works. I can't think of a way to foreclose out from somebody using something that was produced in preparation for the trial. I can tell you, as someone who sits on the bench and listens to those, it gets annoying. Because you get to the point of saying, well, why don't you present your case? You've got the burden of proof. You're trying to discredit someone else who's doesn't have the burden of proof. So you're running a real risk of not prevailing in this case, because even if you discredit everything that they say, you still lose because you haven't presented anything. I remember giving that speech one time. So they do run a risk when they do it that way. Other questions?
Kevin Jacobs, Salt Lake County again. I'd just like to thank the commission for the really good decisions we've been getting on first generation versus second generation appeals. They've really been excellent, and we really appreciate the effort that you've gone through and the fine job you've done on those. They've really been helpful.
We have actually researched that issue in great detail and listened carefully on the presentations on both the taxpayer side and on the taxing authority side. And though we're not prepared to say this is how we're going to rule in every case, because they are fact dependent, you're starting to see a trend, because that's how we think it has actually achieves fair market value as required by the Constitution. Try to do the best research we can, the best legal scholarship we can on it. Anyone else want to make a comment on the dark store issue?
Well, I was just going to make a comment on the idea that we're doing a good job because they turned out the way you wanted them to.
Well, that goes without saying.
We're doing a good job just because we review the evidence, and that you gave us better evidence and a better legal argument.
I'd like to compliment you on the ones we lose, but I'm not sure I do that.
Paul, sometimes our staff doesn't like our opinions, but he does come to us and tell us where he thinks we got it wrong, and after the opinions are done, the appeal rights are over, and we say, thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
So after Kelly's presentation yesterday,
another one that I thought was excellent, by the way. In fact, I kept his answers that were on the analysis and the questions. I may use that again sometime.
Actually, I thought it was really good too. The one decision that probably raised the most questions was the vacant land 501c3 used as a wildlife refuge case. And for I know it's real short notice, but if you're willing and able to discuss that a little, I think it would be helpful.
We can discuss that case and discuss the principles behind it. Would that be helpful to you?
Yeah. Yes.
I wasn't in Kelly's presentation. Did that go to the courts, or was that just us?
That's just.
Okay. Thanks. going to pull back the curtain here a little bit and tell you that we had some vigorous discussion on this one in our deliberations.
Very vigorous discussion on this one. This one was one of those that at first we had a split, and we were still trying to decide. We were trying to decide it, and we actually drafted it a couple of different ways before we finally came up with the decision we did. What we thought was kind of the key factor was that to not overrule a prior decision. That was one of the final things that ended up tilting the decision the way it was. We went back to the 1993 decision that was appeal number 93-0771 and 93-0779. Those appeared to us to give direction as to how the commission should be ruling on the kind of cases. And so we chose not to override that decision.
Was it these kind of cases or just for this taxpayer?
Oh, I guess it was just for this taxpayer, wasn't it? No. Yeah, it was just for this taxpayer.
I think that's how we narrowed
it. You're right. It was just for this taxpayer. Thank you for that clarification. You're right. That's exactly right. So they had prior decisions where the prior commission had ruled in favor of this taxpayer on the same fact pattern. That's what it was, wasn't it?
Right.
It was on the same fact pattern. And so rather than trying to say, well, the prior commission decisions were incorrect, and we are now going to overrule those decisions for this taxpayer on the same facts, we decided to go ahead and stay with the same analysis that they had done for this taxpayer on the same facts. That's how we finally ended up reconciling two positions that the respective commissioners were taking on this case. So that you can read between the lines, pulling back the curtain, as Commissioner Craig indicated, that's a very narrow decision, okay? For a taxpayer on the same set of facts that a prior commission ordered it to rule on, and then coming back on a subsequent appeal on the same facts, saying, well, now we're going to rule differently, that was pretty hard. Will we rule the same way with a different taxpayer with similar facts? That case is not before us. And so we would be declining to really answer that. Although, with those cases there is some persuasive authority that says that these are the way that the commission could rule. Now go ahead and ask your question.
This is Amy Garen Clark, Sevier County Assessor. I brought this appeal to the formal, and the fact was the reason that we brought it to state was because San Pete County, the prior ruling, they had moved a trailer out in the field and were tracking the wildlife and taking students through. Nothing is being done on the land in my county. Nothing.
Were those facts?
Yes, it's in it's. It's in
about
there.
The trailer and the tracking.
Mm-hmm. It was in my evidence.
Okay.
So that's the difference. So that's why I thought we would rule differently.
Who was the commissioner on that one? Because I don't know who said it.
All we have is that Judge Fan conducted it.
And you were there.
He was?
You were.
I was?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, I do remember it because it was the son who was there with his mom and
yes.
Dad was the one who actually set it up, but he
and
passed away.
Yeah.
Well, makes you feel any better, I was on the side that was going to go for you.
Until I
had my arm twisted off.
We really thought after that we had it. We were pretty confident when we walked out.
Say that again. It was...
The prior ruling was San Pete County took them to a state appeal.
Right.
They had a trailer sitting out there.
What I wanted to get was that it was a Sevier County appeal.
Yes.
And that you're in San Pete County.
The San Pete County was the first.
San Pete was the first one.
The first one.
Other way around.
Sevier
was the second one.
Yes.
And were they adjacent to each other? Were they contiguous?
No.
No.
Why didn't you take it to the district court?
My county attorney didn't want to go any farther.
Okay.
He wanted the same ruling you guys gave. He said his predecessor, our county attorney, gave them the exemption, and he didn't want me to fight it at all.
So and they did have exempt property in your county already?
Yes.
Okay.
But they're not using it for anything. So I wanted to know what qualified it as a wildlife refuge and why somebody can't go get a 501(c) and qualify theirs for the same wildlife refuge.
Well, I guess kind of reading between the lines, it's I don't know that anybody else could. The argument really came down to taking away this taxpayer's exemption that they already had. That really was what it was. And I'm not kidding when I say that this was a vigorously deliberated one. It was pretty emotional.
You want to see?
No.
I'm sorry it didn't go the way you wanted it to.
So could I reasonably say that this decision has no precedential value? Because
depends on how full, narrow or broad you want to make that.
Full disclosure, I told Amy, yeah, take that one to the commission. There's not a chance in hell that they'll go the other way. obviously, I was wrong.
Yeah. I would say that we tried to write it so that it was really narrowly, a very narrow fact situation.
So the other question, though, that maybe relates to other cases like a motel in Washington County, if there's a decision in place, the likelihood that you're going to change a previous commission decision is low unless there are significant fact differences.
I thought we had the fact differences.
I'm agreeing with her that she thought she had the fact differences. I think that's kind of what we've said, is that we've asked the question of what changed? Why should we take away an exemption that a taxpayer already has?
Because I wasn't there before.
Well, now I'm thinking more along the unnamed hotel in Washington County, which I was on the other side on that one, too.
We've got to teach you how to do work.
Well, remember the law says that the tie goes to the taxpayer.
I know.
So that's what happens when we have two ties.
Yeah. So.
Of course you do.
Did you have more?
Kathleen Howell, Cache County. I just wanted to add to that because we're talking about 501c3s. I'm finding, and I don't know if the rest have found the same thing, that it's pretty easy to get a 501c3 exemption through the federal government. You can actually purchase them. Not even going through the federal government, you can purchase them outside of that. And we found that with Stevens Henniger. They did not apply themselves, they purchased one that had already been granted elsewhere. So I believe that has become a basis. Once you become a 501c3, it's almost like you've met at 80% now. Now you go further. And quite frankly, I think it's the reverse of that. It's quite simple, at least from my experience in asking people. It's pretty easy to get the 501c3 status from the federal government. So we try to hang our hat on the balance, on the rest of
on
it.
On the use.
On the use, exactly.
Use for
exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you asking us a sales tax question or a property tax question?
No, I'm really just making a comment about the ease. I just don't. Because I would agree with just what I've heard here, was the property used exclusively for the charitable exemption? They may have received the 501c3, but then you have to go to the use.
So the reason that I made that comment is because you're absolutely right. If somebody's got a 501c3 certificate, there's a lot of sales and use tax benefits that they get from that. But in the property tax context, we've got those constitutional provisions. And so even though it feels like 80% of the battle, I would say that 501c3 only addresses one prong of the constitutional test, and that's that it's owned by a charity. And after that, you've still got to meet all the rest of the prongs in the test, and it's that's the place where I think everybody loses. The exclusive use for a charitable, religious, or educational purpose.
Great discussion.
I have one question, and I'll try and ask this very generally because it may actually come up before you. But as far as what qualifies it as educational, and how should we deal with this legislatively? And so I'll try and deal with it narrowly. There's no definition in the property tax statute as what actually is educational. And so in my mind, you know, you need to have a curriculum and you need to have students. Some other folks have said no, life experience is also educational as well. So is there a way for us to deal with that legislatively?
That's pretty tough, because we've dealt with that in the legislature in another context, especially in the areas where people have literary goals, and they use that as their educational basis. And the literature is not necessarily reading, it's seeing movies or having live entertainment, which they say is educational. So we've wrestled with that in other contexts besides just the tax area as to whether or not they qualify for educational exemptions, for example, for wine testing and some of the things that are dealing with the Alcohol Beverages Act. That's an area that's always been fraught with fact patterns to try to determine whether factually it is education or factually if it's more similar to entertainment or recreation.
So we do have a few cases out there that deal with this issue, and I believe there is some case law from the courts too. And so possibly looking at what the reasoning in those cases, and then asking the legislature if they want to codify it, might be the way to approach it, simply because the legislature does have that authority. Once the courts have spoken, they can adopt a statute that overrules the courts, or they can decide to codify the judicial decision. And they did that in the Tax Act. I think it was the burden of proof that had already been, that came out of case law, and then it was codified by the legislature a couple of years ago right into the tax code. So that might be the way to approach it.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Julie Medley, Carbon County Assessor. I have a question I'm not sure if you're going to be able to answer, because I'm not really sure if they're going to appeal on this case or on this matter. But I had a subdivision in a recreational area that was on Greenbelt before I came into office. And now that it is one of my reappraisal areas, I noticed that it was, or seen that it was listed as lots, sold as lots, the legal description shows it's lots, so I put a lot value on every single one of those for this tax year. So now they're questioning me, telling me that I can't do that because I interpreted the Greenbelt law wrong. But if you look at the code under 592.504.3b, it says surface improvements mean curb, gutter, or pavement. So they're saying there is not a curb, there's not a gutter, there's not pavement. But there's roads, there's electrical boxes, there's water, sewer. Are those things not considered surface improvements for a platted subdivision?
I think you've got strong arguments to make if an appeal comes before us. Did you say that they've actually sold some of the lots?
Yes.
So don't you have are they 5-acre lots?
They're at least seven. is the smallest.
We have some comparable sales with the same.
But what I'm thinking is you have a change in ownership, so the new owner's going to have to apply for mm-hmm. Greenbelt.
And some have not, but some have. But now they're just upset this year because their taxes, that's what they're upset about is the taxes. You know, they went from like $4 to $400 because I put a lot value based on what they were selling for.
And then you assess the rollback as well?
Yes.
I don't think that the action you've taken is unreasonable, but I don't think we can answer your specific question until we've got an appeal before us. But that's
I didn't know if you could or not, but it just, like, you know, it only gave you three examples of surface improvements, so that's what they're fighting me on.
Read the statute again. Is it an exclusive list, or is it a...
It just lists those three.
Is the word include in there anywhere?
Okay. It says surface improvement means one curb, two gutter, or three pavement. But I'm in a recreational area, so you're not going to have curb or gutter or pavement.
Interesting.
Dirt roads.
It'll be a good case when it comes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
But that's also one that may want to add to your legislative agenda to be able to recognize that if the statute is interpreted by agencies or by the courts to mean that's the exclusive list, that doesn't really reflect reality.
Very much improved.
I'm sure that Senator Hinkins would like to hear that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Then. Others? Are we ready to wrap it up then? Oh, we got one more there.
Joel Thompson, Garfield County. I just want to say thank you for the prompt turnaround you have on your appeals. It's getting faster every year. And with our taxpayer, you know, two or three reams of paper, it's really hard to keep year to year separate. So I really appreciate how quick you're turning them over.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
And let me just say this on behalf of the commission, that we have made a very concerted effort the last 3 years to really watch our dockets, to really control how fast those decisions get out. We want to make certain we have the quality, the legal work that we're doing is being something that's being actually lauded by the Supreme Court, saying, you know, we're doing a good job on the legal work. So we've been really working hard to try to make certain that the cases don't languish, that once a case has been fully tried, that we get the decision out in a timely manner. We internally have some internal deadlines that we're trying to meet. They're not statutory, they're not by rule, they're just internally that we're trying to watch our dockets. But thank you for recognizing that you've seen some effort to get those decisions out timely. Questions or comments?
They want to go home.
I think they want to go home. Well, let's do this. Again, thank you very much for staying for the last day, and thank you very much for a great conference, Denny. I mean, the assessor school was one of the best.
So I would like to recognize Tammy. She did all the heavy lifting to put that on.
And she was the one who had the guts to go call the chief of staff and invite him to speak to us, and he accepted. Thank you very much, Tammy. So with that, I'll accept the motion.
Move that we adjourn.
Motion is to adjourn. Those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We'll pass it unanimously. We're adjourned. As you can tell,